number two for the interwar years here at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, Mises Academy, and welcome to the second class of the course. This is the interwar years. It's a history of the world between the wars, and this is the second of six sessions. So I wanted to say a little bit about our class today. It's a very interesting class, and I did a little work looking at this sort of short biographical material that's on your personal page, and we've got, I think, 43 or 44 or something like that in the class at this point, and 13 or 14, I believe, have taken courses of mine before in the Mises Academy, and I mentioned that last time, and I salute you for it. I thank you very much for coming back. I'm glad you have found it of some value to do so. And of those 13 or 14, I counted up about four or five whom I have met either in person or on the phone, and become much better acquainted with some of them, and a little bit acquainted with others. I think Jeff Escobar, I believe you have taken just about every course I've done, and then we've seen each other at the Mises Academy. I've seen Savannah Liston at the Mises Academy, and Red Skiles. We've talked on the phone a good deal and corresponded over the last several years. So and there are others also that I could mention along the way. But those of you who are taking it again, I salute you. I did some counting also, and I figured out from our list that we cover at the moment about 16 states and 10 different countries. So that's pretty decent coverage. And and I wanted to also say a welcome to a new student who signed up this week. Didn't quite get signed up last week, but it is my father who has joined the course as a student, and I am delighted to welcome him. My positions and thoughts on individualism and collectivism, and many of my political views and all kinds of other views are directly attributable to him. So here's a good chance for me to thank him for that and to greet him. He's in front of his computer at his home in Weatherford, Texas. So glad to have you with us, and hope you approve of the course. So anyway, that's it. We'll have plenty of time for questions at the end. As you may know, if you were at the session last week, or if you've heard the recorded session, the way it works is that I'll talk pretty uninterruptedly. The only thing that stands in the way to all that is that I have to look down at the little chat list and read it while I'm also looking at the lecture. But I'll try to keep track of all that. And if you have a big question, put it on the chat line, and maybe I'll look down and see it. And if worse comes to worse, then I'll answer it in the question and answer. So I'll go for a while here. We'll see how it goes. We'll leave at least 30 minutes, probably more, for questions and answers at the end. And I think that's how we'll accomplish it. So without further ado, let's take a look at where we're going this evening. This is class two about the interwar years, and here we deal with the period of the Paris Peace, not just the Paris Peace, certainly that, but with the period of the Paris Peace. And I have a theory for it. You know that already. You know, I don't think it's any great secret. Many of you probably agreed with me before you ever heard me say it. But I feel like the Paris Peace was a kind of design for a violent century, a century of dislocation, a century of the need for reconstruction because so many things were destroyed. But we'll get to that a little bit later. So another roadmap this week. First, before we talk about the politicians and the George Washington, the ship George Washington steaming its way across the Atlantic with Woodrow Wilson and the inquiry aboard, I want to talk some about the background conditions to the conference that I think are very, very important. And so it's a little bit of background history that starts where we left off last week and takes us forward. And so the first thing I'm going to talk about is hunger and disease. Then we'll shift over and think a little bit about the Bolsheviks and what they're up to. Then collapse and revolution in Central Europe. And then we turn to the conference, the gathering of the peacemakers, and I'll talk a little bit about more about my ideas about the design for a violent century. And then some specifics, the disarmament of the defeated Central Powers, border changes, changes in economic operations, and so forth. And then the beginning of our talking about the Middle East, because we have to do that several times in the course of the course to kind of keep track of that. And so we'll start talking about the Middle East. And then just a word at the end about the impact of culture, which also we'll deal with as we go along here. In this course about the interval years. So there's the roadmap, and let me just make sure I've got this cursor mastered. It's up here, and let me just ask this. I'm going to point it out. I'm going to press down and put that just to the left of the word roadmap. Does that work for everybody? I mean, can you all see it? Okay. Cam can. Okay. All right. If two have seen it, three, good. All right. So what happens to the arrow? Is that little Hunt Thule arrow now up above? I mean, does it stay there when I press it down? Or yes. Okay. Well, I guess that's good. I guess we'll leave it pressed down. Okay. Well, I'll figure that out. Maybe when I release the cursor, that stays permanently or something. So I've got that figured out. Okay, very good. Just wanted to test the technology, and let's go. I mean, we ended last week pretty much with the Germans and the French in the Compiègne Forest, and the Ottoman Empire ending with the armistice of Mudros and so forth and so on. By the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month, November 1918, then the war was technically over. Though there's, we got to say this, and it's appropriate for a violent century, there was fighting and war somewhere practically every minute for the next 5 years. Places in the Middle East were being bombed, cities were being occupied, people were being slaughtered, populations were being forcibly exchanged or ethnically cleansed. Troop movements were happening with division-sized units in nearly every border of Poland, in the Baltic, in Russia. Of course, the Civil War goes on till 1921. So when we talk about the peace that people welcomed in celebration, I remember my grandmother told me about the delirium in her school in Kentucky when the war ended and the people just danced in the street. But when you know, you have that delirium, but in fact, the violence was not over, and for several reasons. So, the first reason is the hunger and disease, and I think this is really important. This I think a very moving a drawing by the left wing anarchist social artist Käthe Kollwitz, the German. The great German artist, 1924. It's called the German Children of Starving. The war itself dislocated, it dispossessed millions of citizens. It produced enormous hunger all over Europe. And not just talking about the hunger blockade, I'm talking about if you read Herbert Hoover's memoirs, and whatever you think of Hoover's role at the beginning of the Depression later on, in the war years, He presided over a relief organization that went first to Belgium, then to Poland, then all over the world, and gave relief to literally millions of people. I mean, it was quite an amazing thing. And I think he outdid many of the other kind of charitable organizations that were oftentimes on the ground as well. So a lot of dedicated individuals worked in that and tried to do something about it. But the background of that is that millions of people in Eastern Europe and Poland and some in Western Europe and Central Europe were starving, even in the areas that were theoretically friendly to the Entente powers, that is our the United States side in the war. I shouldn't say ours, the United States. But also, of course, the hunger blockade that the British and the Allies maintained produced special privations for Germany and Austria-Hungary. Food supplies, it is now estimated in the most recent studies, food supplies for the Central Powers was at about 50% at the end of the war from what it was in 1914. Probably 800,000 German civilians died of starvation-related causes. I mean, so many times you die of pneumonia, but the reason is that you were half starved to death when you contracted it, or some other disease. And in many cases, starvation contributed to other diseases as well. Similarly, for Austria-Hungary, about a third of all deaths of civilians in the city of Vienna, for example, were calculated to be war-related. And this is crucial, the British continued to maintain that blockade until the treaty was signed. So for those people who argued that the treaty in some form or fashion was not a dictated treaty, and that word is all kind of thought of as being too revisionist and too, pro-German. But if anybody thinks it's not a dictated treaty, then think of that. We will not let you eat. These are countries that import food. We will not let you eat until you sign this treaty. So all of these influences meant that that Europe and related places were very, and the Middle East to some extent, were very, very hungry places. They were malnourished, and mortality rates were extremely high. Here's a picture of a typical picture from Austria-Hungary and Germany. Food riots were very common from about 1916, 1917 on, and people would just break into a butcher shop or a baker's shop, usually thinking that there were big stores of things just being held back by the local baker, and they got the blame for it. But I think this is a street scene you would have seen thousands of times over during the war and in the years after, in the year after, too. Hunger and disease, they certainly went together. Disease was almost certainly an immediate byproduct of World War I, even without the hunger, however. I'm just back from doing some research in Vienna, and one thing that emerged was that in the internment of enemy aliens in Austria, within the first month, the herding together of people in primitive circumstances without proper hygienic facilities and so forth, this led to the outbreak of typhus. Austria had not been at war for a month, and there were cases of typhus in the countryside of Lower Austria. So typhus reappeared. It's when people get together and are in big groups and are herded together and are in too close a proximity, too little hygiene, and so forth. And this was the case, the reemergence of all kinds of other classic camp diseases. There were a million names for fevers in say, the American Civil War, the Franco-Prussian War, the First World War. It's sometimes called trench fever or camp fever or any number of other ones. And it's just a fact that when human beings get together without the urban technologies to protect hygiene, that they get that these sicknesses come about. So the fact of people being crunched together in training camps or in internment camps or POW camps, this led to diseases anyway. So in a sense, what I'm describing here is an increase in disease and a background of disease that is essentially state-sponsored. Not that the state realized this would happen, but it's certainly a case in almost every one of these diseases of something that the state created that then produced the disease. And then we move to one of the great killers in all of human history, the flu pandemic of 1918-1919. All the values for this have been, by recent research and especially by scientists and demographers, all the recent research has bumped all the totals very, very high. We used to say that maybe 20 million people were killed worldwide from the pandemic, and now it's quite clear that it's about 50 million and probably upwards of 100 million, somewhere in between. That's very difficult to say. It was a huge, huge catastrophe, and we might say a kind of government-sponsored catastrophe. The origins of that flu, they're still very much up in the air. Even by place and by method and so forth. I mean, the virus itself is known. There are many variants of that virus. There was one variant that went around a couple of years ago. But how this transferred itself from the bird population to the swine population, the most frequent theories are that this emerged in the huge training camp. We mentioned it last week in the question and answer at Etaples in France, Etaples. Right. And it was an enormous training and hospital camp, and they had big herds of swine there to feed people. And there was a lot of filth and hygienic facilities and birds and whatnot. So the theory is that there. Another theory, and this is by the great historian Crosby, who's done a lot of work on the environment and history. And he thinks it all kind of got a critical mass at Fort Riley, Kansas. As certainly in America, it seemed to radiate from Kansas and Nebraska and Oklahoma and North Texas, and that's where the victims were. But it went all over very fast. That, by the way, is where Walt Disney got the flu and was nearly killed in a camp at Fort Riley. Here's an interesting new piece of information in all this mountain of research on the flu. In a 2009 paper, Karen Starko is now pointing out this interesting thing. In 1918, the United States Surgeon General and in training the U.S. Navy and in the Journal of the American Medical Association recommended the use of super high doses of aspirin to treat the disease. And it turns out that this disease was especially damaging to mucous membranes. Some people who died actually from the Spanish flu, the flu of 1918, just bled out through their various mucous membranes. But it turns out that aspirin in high doses become a poison, and they work on your mucous membranes to compromise those. So one of Karen Starko's ideas in this article, and I give you the full article is printed at the Oxford Journals. You can go read that. But one of her points is that this announcement by the Attorney General and the Navy and all the authorities, the government authorities, that people should take overdoses of aspirin was that this raised the death toll considerably. And not just in America, she traces this also to India, where they were chucking down the aspirin as well. So here we have more government-sponsored horrors associated with this war. I'd like to turn now to, and this I should say is the background to the peacemaking process. I mean, all these well-dressed, well-fed, extremely well-fed diplomats in Paris were there in this, with this background of desolation behind them. Although the flu didn't stay out, and of course it killed a number of the peacemakers, including the British diplomat and spy Mark Sykes, who was part of the Sykes-Picot arrangement that we'll talk about in connection with the Middle East. The flu got him, but and a few others. I mean, Wilson was sick, and it may have contributed to his apoplexy when he got back to America or something. But in any case, it was damaging. So let's keep an eye on the Bolsheviks for a minute. There's our man Lenin right there on the poster. Lenin said socialism plus electricity equals communism. And there you have a big power, a big dam or something being built, a big technology thing, and Lenin pointing to way to the future with his left hand, I might point out. But just a very, very quick primer on the Russian revolutions, which I mentioned briefly last week. Remember, 1917, there are two revolutions. The first one is the February Revolution, and Prince Lvov, a fairly liberal nobleman, took over. The government was, the monarchy was ended. The Romanovs were hustled off the throne. This provisional government then kind of opened the floodgates of civil rights to Bolsheviks and other revolutionaries, the SRs too, there were many more social revolutionaries, but to all kinds of revolutionaries come back to Russia. Summer of 1917, the Bolsheviks hit on their great piece of election propaganda, takeover propaganda. That was the call for land, peace, and bread, meaning that they give bread to the workers in the cities and land to the peasants and peace to everybody. By the summer of 1917, the army started disintegrating on all fronts, and suddenly Soviets or councils began to rise up. This was independent of the Bolsheviks, really. They began to emerge in all kinds of towns and cities and factories and precincts and just take power. These were more anarchists than they were centralized. But the Bolsheviks latched on to the councils or the Soviets and eventually made that part of their the name anyway, part of their own movement. The provisional government came to be under a socialist, a social revolutionary named Kerensky. He was from a smaller party than the social revolutionary main group, but from a socialist party. And Kerensky was in power when the Bolsheviks seized power in October or November 1917. And the Civil War resulted almost immediately. We have to keep that in mind. Just a very quick rundown on the consolidation of the regime. Any of you could probably name all these things, and some of you have been through these a couple of times with me. But just let me point out that the Bolsheviks immediately declared a war on communism. That was actually patterned on the German command economy of the Hindenburg program during World War I. The Bolsheviks immediately did what they could to destroy capitalism, to destroy the elites who had run capitalism, to destroy all the old elites who might be opposed to them, and many who might not be opposed to them. They were especially concerned to destroy all of their socialist rivals. In doing all this, they practiced hideous cruelty, which was in keeping with the doctrines of Marx and Lenin. Part of this was to organize the almost superhumanly harsh secret police, the Cheka, and in the concentration camp system that followed. Destruction of religious life, industrialization at the expense as its collection of grain from the field, starvation of peasants. All of this within the first year. I mean, this was all just the beginning. And when people began to fight back, then that emerged as the Civil War. So just a very quick kind of reminder there. The whites fought the Reds. Of course, the Reds were the Bolsheviks, and the whites in the Civil War consisted of, a lot of forces, sometimes ragtag forces put up by regional governments or industrialists in a given region, and generals by an old Russian general or admiral. These were not very effective. They were not working together, and the Bolsheviks always managed, under the military leadership of Trotsky, oddly, to be able to fight where they needed to fight. That's in spite of the intervention by the Allies, because there was quite substantial Allied intervention. It may surprise you to know that all of the countries listed there on the right on that slide intervened in the Russian Civil War, including Americans, whom you see in marching down the street in Vladivostok in this photograph. But again, the white forces were unconnected, and in many cases, the intervening European armies had an agenda that didn't match up with the agenda of the white forces, and more coordination would have been needed, because the Bolsheviks, in spite of the fact that they were ragtag, they were utterly ruthless, and they had the advantage of being in the center of things, so they could always go out to the edges and fight off this threat, and then go to the other side and fight off that threat. That's the real meaning in the Dr. Zhivago story of the, you know, the revolutionary zealot leader who's in that train and the going to all these spots on the, zipping around the command in all these spots on the front. So here's a picture of Allied intervention, but again, it shows you that the Bolsheviks basically controlled the kind of what in military terms would be called interior lines. In other words, they could move their forces to the whatever the periphery is that the attack goes on now. And now, if everybody had attacked at once, that would have been a different story. But again, coordination was the issue. This was a war carried out with the greatest cruelty. After a while, after a very short while, nobody's taking any prisoners of any kind. They all pretty much, the whites win a battle, they kill all the Bolsheviks because they hate them. The Bolsheviks win a battle, they kill all the white prisoners because they're opposed to the revolution. And so scenes like this happens to be a white victory and a Bolshevik loss, so those are dead Bolsheviks there. But there's hundreds of pictures of both sides. I mean, there's just not any mercy in this war. Meanwhile, at home, very important organization begins to take place. And it's at first, it's just another version of the Socialist International. The Socialists had been meeting under various organizational schemes for about 50 years, and at the time of 1920, and they call these organizations internationals. And so the international that Lenin declared was the Communist International, and so this international was supposed to be all the communists all over the world. By now he's calling Bolsheviks communists, and he's saying this is all the communists all over the world, and they're meeting for solidarity. In reality, of course, they were all meeting to get orders from Lenin and the Council of People's Commissars and his inner circle and so forth, and then they would go back to their country and carry out the will of the Bolshevik leaders. And very soon after the war, by 1920-21, just after this picture was taken, here you see a ragtag group, apparently, of people from various countries around the world, and especially places that have been imperialized or something. But very soon, this organization, come down and called it Comintern, became an actual part of the Soviet foreign policy, and it was designed to subvert other countries, to bring them to a stage of revolution, etc. So, I include this picture because we're going to be talking a lot more about the common turn, and I think it's good to know that turn. And so let's turn now to collapse in revolution in Central Europe. These are things, I think everybody knows about the Bolshevik Revolution a little bit. And these are some revolutions that you probably know a little less about. So let's take Germany to begin with, and we'll go down the line. As I mentioned last week, just before the armistice, Germany broke into revolution. And it happened in Kiel first, the northern German port city of Kiel. And this was one of the more important naval bases. And as the war began to be ended, as the armistice was being negotiated, as the admirals of the German Navy found out that Germany would surrender, they looked back on their record during the war and figured out they had only gone out basically once and then fought the British at the Battle of Jutland in 1916, and then they'd steamed back home and kind of waited for the next big chance. So they didn't seem to have any, they didn't seem to have done anything. And I think it was a point of honor for them that, well, if we're going to lose, let's at least go down fighting. And so these admirals ordered the Navy to get ready for a cruise, and everybody knew it was going to be this big Titanic and suicidal clash with the British in the North Sea. And so the sailors who had sat at port twiddling their thumbs to some extent throughout the war, and who had been watching the revolution in Russia, and who had been thinking about, well, you know, these big shots, why can they order us around? These guys said, wait a minute, we're not going to be murdered when we nearly survived the war. All our cousins in the trenches are dead. And so why should we be murdered too here at the last minute for nothing? We're just for the pride of our leaders who should have sent us out earlier. So there were mutinies, and they began to form councils. And this sounded ominously like those councils, those Soviets in the midst of the Bolshevik Revolution that had been formed only 1 year previous. So there were soldiers and sailors councils formed. The mutiny spread from naval base to the cities, to Bremen, Bremerhaven, all the places where the German Navy was at port. And then from those cities, like an infection, revolution spread to the big cities in Germany, including Berlin and Munich, of course, and other places. Now, you remember a liberal nobleman, Prince Max, had been put in charge of the government in order to make it easier to negotiate with the Allies. And at this point, once the revolution started, Prince Max just simply said, well, we can't do it. We can't run a revolutionary government. We're all basically bourgeois liberals, and the people in the streets are calling for something different. So we have to do something different. And so what he did was just to call these two guys at the bottom of their boat, Philipp Scheidemann on the left and Friedrich Ebert on the right. And he said, okay, you guys are socialists. You take over. And so he handed the reins of the government at the 11th hour, just before the surrender, to these two guys. Now, you can look at these guys. They had a lower middle class or even lower class past. Ebert's father was a leather tanner. I mean, he was from a, you know, working family. But on the other hand, these socialists, the day of the truth, were all they were quite patriotic Germans, and they had no desire to see a Bolshevik revolution or anything like it in Germany. So these guys took over, and at that moment, then on the right, the picture on the right shows us Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, the leaders of a new communist party called the Spartacus League, whipping up the enthusiasm of the crowds to just take over and recreate the Bolshevik Revolution in Germany. Fighting broke out in the streets, and Ebert just called the general staff and said, "Look, guys, we're not the revolution, but there's one happening, and we'll guarantee you, if you follow us, we're not going to disband the army, but we need your help." And so the army cooperated. A lot of volunteers back from the front weren't about to let their country be taken over by Bolshevik types. And so there was fighting in the streets. It got very deadly. But the radical revolution was put down. And I'm talking now about in the month of December and early January. And then in the midst of all these events, Germany had a general election to elect an assembly to produce a constitution. You know, the Kaiser had been sent off. There's no more monarchy. There's a republic, and so they had to produce a constitution. And they looked for some place to go to make that constitution. And they thought about it and thought about it and said, "Well, we can't make this in Berlin because, you know, what happens in the French Revolution is that they're making the constitution in Paris, and the radicals burst in and start killing the constitution makers. So we can't do that." And so they chose a place that was pretty far off the beaten path, a small city, had a big theater where they could, all 500 delegates could meet. And that was in the city of Weimar, the old cultural center of Germany. And so they didn't move their capital. They just moved there to make the constitution. And hence the constitution that emerged in the middle of the summer, almost exactly the same time as the treaty signing. That constitution was called the Weimar Constitution, and hence we call Germany from the Germany that honored this constitution from 1919 until 1933, we call that Weimar Germany. Okay, so that's how that goes. And this kind of summarizes that. But there were many uprisings, and there are radical movements right and left. I mean, this republic was besieged, and I've got to say, I'm kind of, even though it was a kind of social welfare republic and a republic of just blunt, open interest politics, where there were dozens of parties and they all had their own thing they wanted. It was true democracy in that sense, in the sense that most Austrians and libertarians would note that it was people trying to vote somebody else's money into their pocket. And in spite of all that, I have many sympathies with the Weimar Republic and many of the folks who were trying to make that constitution work and all that. But of all these attempted takeovers, Hitler's Bierhoff, which was one of these takeovers from the right, and about that we'll talk later. Now, there's an analogous Austrian revolution that takes place exactly the same time. Think of this. Austria-Hungary is a huge, big empire. It's multinational, has 15, 16, 17 different nationalities in it, depending on how you count. And there's a lot of pressure during the war to a country that was already under a kind of ethnic identity pressure from all directions. And so when the war began to be lost, when the country began to fall apart, when it looked like Germany was going to negotiate the armistice, then Austria fell, first of all, Austria-Hungary, into its component countries. In other words, the Bohemians and the Czechs declared their independence, and other groups did, and Austria was kind of left a little bit alone. But even before that, as far back as January 1918, mass strikes began. I mean, people were protesting the war in all kinds of ways. But Austria-Hungary collapsed in and of itself, essentially, in October 1918. And then after that revolution broke out in Kiel, after the German revolution broke out, then there were mass demonstrations, such as this one pictured here in front of the Austrian Parliament in 1918. So the government, just as in the same way that the German government did, handed power over to the Socialist Party and the Socialist and a republic, the Austrian Republic, not necessarily a Socialist Republic, was declared on November 12th. Now, the guy at the bottom, of course, Mises is on the right, and the guy at the bottom of this slide is Otto Bauer, who became the head of this socialist government. And they had known each other for years. I mean, they were old friends. And this is kind of where Mises comes in. I haven't mentioned this prominently in the first class, but we are following Guido Hülsmann's great and noble book on Mises as the last night of liberalism. And one of the things that you know is that Mises thought he should go to war. He thought he should do his duty. He thought he should defend his country. He went to war as an artillery officer, had a very rough and ugly war, almost all the time in the mountains. He must have been freezing cold the whole time. He had injuries. He played through the pain. He did everything. But periodically he would come back, he would have to come back to Vienna to recuperate. And there he saw the war government that was happening. He saw the manipulation of the currency. He saw all the things that were going on. And he was already an accomplished economist. He had already written his first books and so forth. And so he comes back at the very end of the war and realizes that things are collapsing into a kind of Bolshevik style situation. And since his own motto that he's chosen from a very early age is "Do not give in to evil, but proceed ever more boldly against it," then here's where that really kicks in, and Mises becomes a prominent opponent of the socialist revolution, a prominent truth teller to his acquaintance Otto Bauer, a prominent fighter through the Chamber of Commerce and through his writings and through personal contacts, tireless personal contacts to try to keep Austria from becoming something like a Bolshevik dictatorship. And in the end, he won out. I mean, Austria was, in those years, it didn't become a perfect vision of a country, but I guess considering what the modern state is, there is no perfect vision. But at least it didn't become the end of civilization, which is what Mises continually feared. So here's the heroic, one of the heroic parts of Mises. There are many aspects of him that are heroic, but this is it's in the midst of this revolution that Mises comes to the fore, and regardless of the consequences, and he suffered many consequences for all of these stands he took in his life, but this is certainly one of the more important ones. And in his notes and recollections, he has this I think a very calm passage about Bauer. But it is interesting. Otto Bauer was too bright not to realize that I was right. But he never forgave me for having turned him into a neo-hole. And that was a French socialist who got to power and realized that he didn't really like socialists very well, and that he should rely on the conservatives in France. And so Bauer is pushing against becoming a non-socialist in office, but he finds out he has to in order to stave off the Bolsheviks. He never forgave me. The attacks of his fellow Bolshevists hit close to home, but he directed his animosity toward me instead of toward his opponents. A powerful loather, he opted for ignoble means to destroy me. So that's an important part of this history. And Guido Hülsmann's book is long. It's 1,100 pages. We're not reading all of it in this in this course, but if you can get to that, somebody asked me this week in the forum about the priorities of the books, and I would almost always give that one priority. In other words, if you can't read anything else, I'd probably read that. Because a lot of the other things will come across in the lecture, but these details about the life of Mises and his circle and the comments on Hayek and the development of his books in the midst of, totalitarianism and socialism and all that, it's highly interesting and highly useful. So I would prioritize that as the top thing. And then I would read all the rest if I could. Here's another comment on that, just to mention it again. I discussed this last week. The readings are designed for somebody who's got some hours to devote to this, and it's a lot of reading, maybe 200 pages a week or something. And not everybody can do that. Not everybody wants to do that. And you take the course for your own purposes. For those of you who really do need a grade and a letter or something at the end of this, do by all means read as much as you can. For the rest of you, read what you want to and what you find interesting. A lot of these selections online are just short little things. We're going to look at the, I haven't plugged it in yet, but we're going to look at the party platform of the Nazi Party next week. And, you know, it takes 3 minutes to read. It's no big deal, but it's very, very interesting and very useful to know. And so there are a lot of things like that you certainly can do, even if you don't have much time or if you're in a bad spot or if you're moving or whatever. So I'll just leave that for the moment. A word about the Czech lands. Part of what became Czechoslovakia belonged to the Austrian part of the empire. Part of it belonged to the Hungarian. The Slovakian part belonged to Hungary. And the Czechs declared their independence in 1918. This was the closest, in many ways, the closest of the new states that would emerge, the winning states, theoretically, to Woodrow Wilson, who really took a shine to Tomas Masaryk, who spent the war largely in the United States. And the Czechs looked forward to an alliance for a state. In Hungary, that huge part of the empire, there was a socialist revolution there too, under a socialist named Károly, beginning 31st of October, just like the Austrian one. And the king, King Karl the Fourth, who was the last Habsburg emperor, accepted the Hungarian Democratic Republic on the 16th. But in March 1919, the communist, the Bolshevik Béla Kun, took power from the socialists, proclaimed the Soviet state, and began to carry out the whole socialist program in Hungary. The Allies, however, and this we have to discuss in just a moment, the Allies' views on the Bolsheviks. And in a word, they didn't like them. And so what the Allies did was to send in interventionary forces into Hungary and drive Béla Kun and his guys out, and so that Hungary became eventually a republic. Just a word on Béla Kun. Some of you have seen this slide before. It was in the totalitarian course or something like it. And just a little rundown on this guy. His name was originally Cohn. He was from within the empire and fought in the army. But when he was in a Russian POW camp, he was indoctrinated and became a communist. Participated in the Bolshevik Revolution and so forth. Anyway, as some of you know from that course, the poor old Béla Kun, you know, went back to Moscow after he was born out of home and spent the rest of his life on special missions for the Comintern, but he was purged by Stalin in 37 and shot in 38. So much for poor old Béla Kun. Okay, well, that pretty much completes the roundup of collapse and revolution in Central Europe. And I think you'll agree with me, it was pretty dire circumstances and political upheaval in in all these lands that they're the middle of Europe. I mean, we're talking about an area where a huge portion of Europe's population lives in the German-speaking part of Europe and related areas, Hungary, Bohemia, and so forth. And so this is quite an enormous upheaval that's happening as the peace conference is going on. So now let's gather the peacemakers. There's Clemenceau on the left and Wilson and Lloyd George. There's a wonderful British war artist who was commissioned by the British government to make portraits at the conference. And he did some great paintings of the Paris Peace Conference. You can find him online. I wrote a little section about him in my blog a few years back. And his memoirs are also online and are wonderful, wonderful reading because he sat so many hours talking to all these people he painted. But one of these people he sat for hours painting was Woodrow Wilson. And so these little sketches didn't ever make it to the public view. These are his own sketches of the peacemaker as he really is. And he didn't care much for the peacemaker as he really was. He kind of saw him for a fairly trivial and bumptious and self-righteous character. Now, the other two important members of the Big Four, and I'm going to leave Vittorio Orlando of Italy aside for the moment. The other two important ones were Georges Clemenceau, the Pranger, and David Lloyd George, the wild Welshman. And these are, as somebody said, these are the individuals whom the enormously complicated and tough political systems of these two different countries, France and Britain, through lifelong careers in the school of hard knocks, these are the ones who are coughed up onto the top of the heap to become war prime ministers. In other words, the wiliest of the wily and the toughest of the tough. And they were sitting there with this guy. I mean, this also emerges if you read that piece from Keynes's account of the peace conference. And we're reading that Keynes book for this session. It's a chapter on the economic consequences of the peace. And you can tell, I mean, all the British people who talked about Wilson couldn't stand him for a variety of reasons, but one of them was that he was just so self-righteous. So here they are. That's Orlando, you can see here. That's there we go. Orlando, that's not Hunt Tooley, that's Orlando. And then, of course, Lloyd, you talking Lloyd George. And this is a moment early on, I believe, if I'm recalling correctly, early on at peace conference when they were all playing like they were still friends in some way. But in fact, by the time it was over, they pretty much all hated each other. They all had very different interests. The British had completely different interests from the French completely different interests from the British, and both completely different interests and fears of the American power, and then of the program of Woodrow Wilson. And yet, they all had this similarity in that they were all serial reformers. They were, each of these guys had made his career on the basis of reform of government, and those reforms have always been in a statist direction. I don't really have the time here to go into it, but if you'll just read the Wikipedia on each of these guys, you don't need to go into a long biography to understand this, that they were all serial reformers, they were statists to the core, and that they were all totally willing to forward the goals of the state by killing mass numbers of their own people. So hence my term here, serial reformers, serial statists, serial killers. But they look pretty happy in this picture. Well, they gathered for the peace conference, and let me just make some general points before we go into specifics. It was a dictated peace. The mainstream historians go back and forth on this, and right now there are some who are talking about how well it wasn't such a dictated peace. Well, It was. The Germans weren't there. The Germans weren't allowed to be in Paris during the negotiations. So if you can't negotiate, then it can't be a negotiated peace. The Germans were allowed to come to Paris twice, once to pick up a copy of the finished treaty, the treaty draft, the second time to come to Paris to answer the draft, and the third time to come sign it. So that's only 3 days in an 8 month period. So there was no negotiation. When the Germans said that the Germans said they did not wish to sign, the Allies said, "Good, we'll invade. Your people are already starving, and we'll just invade." And the Germans finally said, "Well, we'll sign this thing, but it's injustice without example." You know, for one thing, if you think about the course of the revolution in Germany, by the summer of 1919, when the Allies were demanding that the evil Germans, the Kaiser's Germans, sign the thing, these socialists and Democrats and liberals, yes, and conservatives, had already kicked out the Kaiser and formed a whole new constitution with a fairly workable Republican government. So, yes, it was a dictator piece. Another point that I'm going to be making as we go along has to do with war finances and war and financial solutions. In other words, we've got to keep in mind that all the powers had hollowed out their economies by inflationary means, that there's this structure we talked about last week of interlocking loans and all that. And these things have to be solved in some way, and part of that's solved in the treaty, and part of it's solved in the years after the treaty. There's a new brutality that gets recognized in all of this, and we'll discuss that as we go along. And we've also got to talk about this term self-determination that Woodrow Wilson introduced into the proceedings. And it turns out to be, and I say this after having studied the stenographical reports, records of the Council of Four and their deliberations among these four guys, Orlando, Comasso, or George Wilson. And it's quite clear that Wilson, when he said self-determination, meant nationalism, that he meant that people of a nation ought to choose whatever their ethnic makeup was. So if you're Polish, you should want to choose Poland as your country. And you should have an affinity for other Poles and so forth. And when it came to a vote in Upper Silesia, he said, "Well, we don't need a vote in Upper Silesia. We just need to figure out if they're Poles or Germans. And then we put the Poles in the Poland and the Germans in the Germany." Never thinking, well, maybe some Poles would like to be in Germany. So anyway, there's that issue that I think is an overarching issue of the conference. And then finally, there's the American problem. And the problem is related to a smart aleck comment by the smart aleck Lloyd George, who said when he was asked how he'd done at the peace conference, he said, "Well, not badly, considering I was seated between Jesus Christ and Napoleon." So this is kind of, in fact, I love this photograph because it sort of gives, sort of characterizes each of our big three guys with Lloyd George looking a little bit satisfied with the whole proceeding. So the American problem is this, that the Americans came in late. They had been relatively unscathed, of course, 100,000 deaths, but relatively unscathed compared to the others. And the strongest country in the world, now with a hand in all the deliberations, and then a president who was this vapid, self-righteous, messiah complex kind of character who had already started, I don't know, I forget what the count is, six, eight, seven wars in his administration, and yet talked endlessly of peace, wanted to get into the war to end war, so he could make the peace to end all peace. He would bring the new world in to correct the sins of the old. He would introduce open covenants, openly arrive at all of these kinds of things. And all the time, he's a man who is essentially, as a progressive, he's essentially in the pocket of the financial interests of the J.P. Morgan house and others. Whether he knows it or not, I suppose his handler, more or less, was Colonel House in all this, who was also at Paris, make no mistake. But you know, apart from this, you know, whose side he's playing for, there is this personal part of it that is very, very interesting. You know, there were these complex, for example, border issues of the Yugoslav border as they're building this new Yugoslavia, the German-Polish border and other places where you can't really see any clear ethnic border. There is one. It's just people are intermingled and they have been for millennia. But Wilson said, well, there's got to be an answer to all this. And so he recruited a bunch of Ivy League professors, called them the Inquiry, and took them on the George Washington with him, assembled them in the stateroom of the George Washington and said, gentlemen, tell me what is right, and I will fight for it. You know, to a mind like Lloyd George's, this kind of thing was just ridiculous. It was just infantile, but dangerous. So this American problem is a pretty big problem, especially since the Americans, and Woodrow Wilson is the front man, in a sense, again, perhaps unknowingly, for the people who had loaned the money to Britain, he may be a person who is personally distasteful, but on the other hand, he's the head of that country and the representative of those interests. Okay, well, let me just, and we're running out of time here, so I'm going to talk more about violence next time. In fact, maybe since I've already discussed this just a little bit in the fourth part of this lecture, I can skip over this slide. I do want to point out that my blog spot that I wrote about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, is sort of a reworking of this theme in a number of different ways, a number of different aspects of this period. And so I've assigned most of those at some point or another, and so I don't know if that's a priority reading, but some of it's not bad. So anyway, you can take a look at that. And I think I'll just leave that and go to some specifics. The Versailles Treaty was signed in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles on the 28th of June, 1919. And I want you to, and that's one of those Orpin paintings. So this painting is where you know, it's for serious, and I really love the text of this guy's painting, William Orpin. You should look him up. So they're not caricatured here, but they still have interesting looks on their faces, and they still exude a kind of, you know, their own personal attitude in all this. But let me explain. There are five treaties of the Paris Peace, and this you can dine out on at some party or another. Five treaties of the Paris Peace, so it's not the Versailles Peace, although that's the most important one. But I mean, there are these other really important countries in the war. And Treaty of the Allied and Associated Powers, the United States being the associated one, after the Congress refused to allow us to go in as a full-fledged Allied member. Versailles was the treaty made specifically with Germany. Saint-Germain was a treaty specifically made with Austria, and then Trianon with Hungary, Louis-Yi with Bulgaria, and the Treaty of Sèvres with the Ottoman Empire. So there were five, these five, and they're all in royal palaces somewhere outside the center of Paris. Some of them are not far out. Versailles is about 18 miles away. Louis-Yi is right in Paris now, but it's not in the center. It's a good metro right away. And so, same with the other places. So, for a long time, historians call these the treaties of the Paris suburbs. And if you want to look at a copy of the Versailles Treaty, it's a really convenient one at firstworldwar.com, and I give you that link there. But the Versailles was the first one made, the harshest one, the one that was the most in the spirit of vindictiveness. And those things worked with the other powers too. But as time went on, especially Lloyd George, and to some extent Clemenceau, were becoming a little less willing to stick it to the losers. But of course, the German one was the most important to them in any case. So just quickly running through issues here, and then we'll get to our question and answer. The Versailles Treaty disarmed Germany. A lot of high-order weapons, artillery pieces and airplanes and tanks and whatnot, were handed over as a condition of the armistice before November 11th. And then those weapons were then prohibited from the Germans. The Navy was all forced to be in turn. The German fleet, the one that didn't sail out because of the German Revolution, was forced to go to one of the main British naval bases in the Orkney Islands at a place called Scapa Flow. So then those, something like 50 battleships were in turn in this huge roads of a harbor in the Orkney Islands. The treaty forced Germany to limit its army to 100,000 men, weapons, tanks, warplanes. It was, the Germans were supposed to stay away from their own border and stay 50 kilometers to the east of the Rhine River. And that means that they were in as many places 100 kilometers from their own border with Luxembourg or France. So you see, it was their own country. And we said, well, you can't protect that part of your country, because we want strategic power over the Rhine, and all that. Well, and all this inspired the fact that, and this is really important for later, for our later studies, when we get up to Hitler's rearming, this is especially important. The very first words of the disarmament clauses goes like this: in order to render possible the initiation of a general limitation of the armaments of all nations. Okay, we're going to disarm you, Germany, but it's just a first step. Then we're all going to disarm. Okay, so this is the everything's predicated on this. Well, we'll all disarm, but you first, and then we'll go. That's really important. Well, when the, you know, these German admirals didn't succeed in going out to a big battle, but they did make a statement. They surrendered their fleet to the British. But then they were, you know, they manned the ships in the harbor and sat around on them. And when they realized what was going to happen, that the treaty would be signed, that the Navy would just be turned over to the British with a few kind of coastal ship exceptions, then they scuttled the fleet and sank it to the bottom of Scapa Flow. And they were pretty successful in that. Most of the ships sank, and that was that. So Germany partly disarmed itself, but those ships would have gone to the British anyway. So I put that in the disarmament section. And there's the battleship. I believe that's the Bremen, but I forget which one that is. It could be the Breslau. No, not the Breslau. Maybe somebody knows, but that's a picture of that ship in Scapa Flow sinking as it was after it had been scuttled by its own folks. So the Germans were disarmed. There's also border changes. And I'm going to follow this throughout all the treaties. We have to talk a good bit about this, not all today, but I want to get started today. First of all, just understand that for the most part, the losers lost territory. In the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the empire was, it pretty much broke up on its own. And then the Allies went to work deciding that, for example, the Czechs were a good part of the empire, and the Hungarians were a bad part of the empire, and the Austrians were a bad part of the empire, but the South Slavs were a good part of the empire, you see. So they made these decisions, and then they gave territory to the people who were regarded as winners. So the Austro-Hungarian Empire, parts of it went to Romania, Italy, Yugoslavia, et cetera, you see, Czechoslovakia. The Ottoman Empire was broken up also, and the territory went to Greece, Syria, and others. Bulgaria lost territory to Greece, Serbia, and Romania, and Germany lost territory to Belgium, France, Denmark, and the big winner from Germany, Poland. Poland also got a lot of Austro-Hungarian territory. I didn't put that on there somewhere, but it certainly did. So there is all that. Now, another interesting thing about this is, and I didn't talk about this at this point, well, a lot of Russian Poland became part of the new Poland because Poland was revived and got land from, well, from all sides. Russia, Austria, everything, and became this huge, big country. So what happened with the Russians? Well, the Russians were in the midst of the Bolshevik Revolution. The British especially, and the Americans to some extent, and even the French, said, you know, we don't want anything to do with revolution. We want to just keep them, those Russians, let them tear each other up, but we don't want revolution here. So let's build up a big safety corridor, a cordon sanitaire, a sanitary zone. And we'll make Poland a part of that and all these other little states, that Czechoslovakia and everything. And we'll just put a big buffer zone between us and the revolution. So they took a huge chunk from Russia, and as the Bolsheviks were in the midst of their civil war, and added that onto Poland and some other states too. So there were many territorial changes in all this. The issues that arose were those of Balkanization, that is to say, breaking everything up into little, not very viable states. Another issue is that there were big winners in all this. Poland, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia is one as well. In other words, you have countries that were taken from the loser's territory and then reemerge as darlings of the Allies. In all these changes, what happened frequently was that in spite of Wilson's fighting for what is exactly right, that many minorities were left on the wrong side of the border. As many, maybe more minorities than had been on the wrong side of some border before. In other words, where there had been quite a few Polish speaking people in German territories before the war, after the war, there were millions of several hundred thousands of Germans on the in Poland and so forth. So what happens then with self-determination? In other words, if we're going to have a status quo where there are minorities, well, and in countries that aren't particularly viable, that could be liable to authoritarian government, what then? Well, eventually we're going to see we build some minority treaties into the League of Nations, but it didn't make much difference. Finally, one of the main issues that we need to follow as we move through this material next week and the week after is these flashpoints, in particular Danzig, and above all, Upper Silesia. So let me just say a few words about Upper Silesia. Then we'll be nearly done. Upper Silesia is a very important section of. It belonged to Germany before the war, and there was one of the few cases where they had a border plebiscite in the wake of the war. And as a result of this plebiscite, then the territory was divided. But the way that came about, a very long occupation, two or three different open uprisings by Polish insurgents, brutal German volunteers coming in to fight the battle. It just made conditions very, very ugly on that border. And this is almost emblematic for what the border changes after the war did. They increased the proclivity and the chances for violence in the new Europe. And that's one thing that we'll have to follow up. Economics in the treaty. Well, the war guilt clause precedes the reparations clauses. So what the Germans worried about all those years as the war guilt clause, it really did say what it says here, that Germany accepts responsibility for causing all loss and damage to the Allies. But on the other hand, it was a formula thought up actually by John Foster Dulles, who was a young man at the conference. It was a way to make sure that the Germans would pay enough in the future by saying, well, they owe all categories of reparations to us, not just damages on the battlefield, but damages to cities and damages to civilians. And Lloyd George wanted to get all of the pensions of all the soldiers who had been killed in it, all of that. And so this was a way of saying, so we can load the whole cost of the war on Germany. But it's also true that Articles 232 through 263 then limited those liabilities in some ways, although they were still pretty enormous. And it never gave a bill. So the bill is only going to come about in 1921 when the Allies get together and create a control commission for reparation. And Germany will owe 132 billion gold marks at the time when inflation is running rampant in the country. And we'll have to talk more about that later. we'll also talk a little bit more about the economics of the treaty, because they're important issues that we will deal with in the next class as well. Colonies, just very quickly, all the colonies of Germany in Africa and South Pacific and everywhere else were taken over by winning powers, saying that they were not going to run them as colonies, but as mandates. So it had that kind of Wilsonian kind of, I don't know, Presbyterian lingo about it to make that all work. So the winners took all, and they did take all. But, you know, since colonies are so expensive and since I'm an anti-imperialist, then this may have been the best thing that could have happened to Germany, just to lose its colonies. But they also took the Ottoman Empire colonies, and I don't know if that was a good value or not, since it led to so much violence in the rest of the century. But we'll talk about that at a later time. There is a quick note on the Middle East here that we need to put in. If you look at this map, this is the whole area of the Ottoman Empire. All of this area, and I'm trying to get that cursor to work. All of this area here, that was the early part of the empire, you see. But much of it had fallen off. But this area from here to here to here to here, all around here, this was all still, you know, part of the Ottoman Empire before the war. And what happened was that this collapsed, and the borders then are actually shrink down to this area that's surrounded by the tan color, or that is the tan color here. And so these are this means that these places become mandates for the British. So Syria, Iraq, Transjordan, and so forth. And so this is going to shape our modern Middle East. And it comes about partly as a result of promises that the Allies made to many sides during the war. And of course, very much into this comes the promise to create a Jewish national state, the Balfour Declaration, that we have to talk about later when we talk about the Middle East more specifically. But the empire surrendered, as we said, in 1918. Many parts of it were already occupied by the British, although the Turks had fought a very extensive and creditable war. But Damascus was taken, Jerusalem was taken, and then finally the Allies moved in and took Istanbul and invaded south, the French invaded south, eastern Turkey, and other powers invaded other parts. So Turkey was really on the ropes. And then so signed whatever was in the Treaty of Sèvres, they just signed and didn't worry about it. But something's about to change there. What happened with their territories was that the mandate system took over, and then the promises also took over. So a kingdom of the Hejaz in this area here was recognized, And some other areas out here that the United States was particularly interested in, and we'll talk about those later. But that's all reformed also as a result of the form. Whoops, I didn't get that completely, that slide completely wrong. That's the liberation of Istanbul. We're really going to look at that next week, so I'll leave that out. And to tell you the truth, since I've gone so long, you haven't. Well, I hope you have. I hope you're still with me. The impact on culture. I think I'll wait and talk about that next week. I had just some very brief comments to set up next week's discussion, but I believe we'll just end this there. I do want to say this: in spite of all these overwhelming kind of collectivist victories that attended this war of total war and total government, and total economy, and all of it, I still am an optimist in this story. And I still say, okay, you get one Mises and one Hayek, and you get, in the wake of all this, you get all these people who stand up for the individual. You get, you start naming Mencken and, whoever you want to. Before they, the class started, Danny Sanchez and I were talking about Will Durant. You get all kinds of people who in one way or the other are really recognizing and reaffirming the value of the individual, just like you get the Tolkien's and the C.S. Lewis's. So in a way, in this very dark period, it produces a kind of coherent counterattack on the collectivists that I think is just really fascinating, and that we want to dig into a little bit next week as we move toward that. So that's all I'll say about the impact of culture, and that's a good way to end the class. And so I think we should open the conference as standard on January 19th, 1919, and except this conference will not be nearly as grandiose as that one. and Nathan says, I think this will be the first question. Do I have any thoughts on Antonio Gramsci as it applies to this course? I'm not sure what you mean by that. I don't have many thoughts on Gramsci in general, but I'm not quite sure what you mean. So if you can rephrase that, I'll take a run at it. Let's see. Is there anything up above? Any question up above that in the chat thing? Let's see. Yeah, there's a good discussion up there, but I don't see any other questions. So let the questions begin. Nathan, can you redo yours? Okay. I know he wrote a lot of horrible socialist papers during the 20s. Well, I mean, I think, Gramsci's known as being kind of a socialist with a human face or something. But yeah, I mean, I think... he's certainly on the left in all this, and I don't know much more to say. I mean, what you're saying is totally correct. But you have to understand that this was the heyday of socialism, but there is this huge, huge rivalry between the what you might call the democratic socialists and the Bolsheviks. In other words, this is one of the things. This is one of the dilemmas that Mises was noting when he talked about Otto Bauer. These socialist leaders, and the same thing with Ebert and Scheidemann. These guys, they wanted a welfare state. They wanted a union state. They wanted sick insurance and child labor laws, and they wanted that kind of thing. They didn't want chaos and overturning the classes. They wanted the laborers to make more money and somehow make it into some kind of new class, as these leaders themselves have done. So there's a tremendous tension and enmity and fighting between socialists of that stripe and then the radical socialists elsewhere. So I think that's that's where Gramsci fits in. He was a theorist of the kind of radical stripe. Oh, and Nathan says, yeah, well, he's mentioned a lot. Oh, he's a great theorist because he seems to be a kind of to a lot of American academics, a kind of a genius of sort of like the young Marx as opposed to the old Marx. Somebody you can read and not be ashamed of. Not really, maybe not really Stalinist at all, but somebody who was thinking of really thinking of the masses. So yeah. Malcolm, to my knowledge, I don't recall that she was able to find any. Your questions about the percentage of aspirin deaths, and I don't think she did. Although she had some interesting. There is an interesting in the article, a lot of interesting data about how many it might have affected. But I don't think she has a. I think it'd be impossible to tell, too. I mean, from a medical standpoint, we could know how many people, you know, took the aspirin. The government recommended aspirin overdoses, I don't know. So let me look. Let me glance up. Cam says, you can say while statism ran rampant in the streets, liberty was born in the back alleys. I like it, Cam. That's a good formulation. And there's some pretty great heroes, you know, born in all that. If you just start counting up Zora Neale Hurston and Rose Wilder Lane and, you know, there's just an awful lot of folks who come along in the 20s and 30s, and I mentioned Lincoln. I mean, you know, you've got these kind of people are fighting against the tide, but they're fighting a really good battle there and laying the groundwork for a lot of later things that come about. Brad Skiles, hey Brad, how you doing? Says, leading up to the Bolshevik Revolution and shortly after the revolution, how is the currency impacted? Well, the Bolsheviks just took over the currency, and eventually they pretty much destroyed the ruble totally, inflated it, made all kinds of laws regarding the ruble. They took all the gold. They did everything you'd think. I mean, it was just a horrifying picture of a total crash of an economic system, and that's one of the miseries of Russia. I mean, I failed to mention that. You know, millions and millions of Russians died at the hands of these revolutionaries and in the course of the civil war that they started. So, and the economic collapse was part of it. Widespread starvation and privation, et cetera, et cetera. So, the currency, it just be exactly what you expect. The ruble was pretty much destroyed. Leslie, hi, Leslie. Leslie says, Mises in Omnipotent Government defended the reparations and said they were not as severe as the Germans made them out to be. How have libertarian historians discussed this argument? That's a good point. And, you know, it's always been where I took my cue from. Because in my time in graduate school, there was a huge, renewed debate among mainstream historians about reparations and whether they were too much to bear, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a couple of factors you have to consider. The Germans could have paid. There's some indication that the Germans may have encouraged the inflation so that they would kind of burn down the village to save it from the Allies. It was a harsh reparation bill, 132 billion marks. But I'll also say this: when the Germans defeated the French in the Franco-Prussian War in 1871. They gave them a walloping big reparations bill. And they collected every cent of it. Now, some of it they collected in kind, and the Allies would do that too. But still, it was a big bill. I forget whether it was 5 billion gold francs. Somebody can look it up. But it was huge. So in a way, if you're the French, you're going to say, are we going to be generous now when the Germans are a lot generous after the Franco-Prussian War? And remember, the Franco-Prussian War was a war in which the Prussians and their other German allies invaded France. So it was a war of invasion. So there's that too. Would the Germans have charged the Allies with reparations if they could have, and, you know, had the situation been reversed? Undoubtedly, yes. And then the other thing is that if you read those other clauses, if you really walk your way through them, you're going to see that on the face of it, the Germans were allowed to pay in. I mean, there's a certain number that part of this that can be paid in swine. Certain part of it can be paid in coal, certain part in lumber, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the Germans could make payments in kind. And moreover, we know now from studies of this that those swine and that lumber and that coal was pretty much overvalued. By the time the Germans got to pay it, the British were feeling a little bit guilty about it, and so they gave them like extra credit for some of those payments. So there's that too. There's also this: the Germans were late on every payment between the war and 1923. If they just made their payments on time, you know, there wouldn't have been any invasion of the Ruhr as eventually happened. So and why do the Allies need all this money? Well, they needed it so they could pay back the Americans, okay? And that's the really important part of all this, that you've got a huge reparations bill, and the British and French and the Belgians want that money so that they can pay back their war debt to the Americans, okay? And that sets up everything for the Dawes Plan, which we talk about next week. So as you can tell, I'm with Mises on this. It is true that the Germans were hit pretty hard, but it was a war of invasion. I mean, whether I'm not trying to make the Germans a sole bad guy, but in the end, they were on French and Belgian soil, and that, by definition, is invasion. So I'm not one of those revisionists who is just looking to clear the Germans of anything they've done. I mean, the state is the state, right? Whether it's the German state or any other state, and the state does bad things to people. That's the nature of it. As Mises said, it's all about violence, and so that's what they do. But anyway, so that's it. I love that question, Leslie, and thanks for asking it. And if I've raised some questions by saying those things, then I'd be glad to talk more about that as well. Cam says, toxic dose of aspirin for male persons was 165 grains. Okay. From Brad again, why were World War I losers required to reimburse the Allies? I'm sure you wrote that too, as I was working on the other question. You realize that in previous wars, you know, people would collect from the losers maybe a tribute or an indemnity, right? But in this war, Wilson said, when the other two were saying, "Yeah, we need to get a tribute or an indemnity, or this, we need to get a lot of loot from the Germans," Wilson said, "Oh no, we can't do that. We're not going to take any indemnity." And the other two were just horrified. Well, Orlando, the other three were just horrified. And Wilson said, instead, we'll just make the Germans pay enough to repair all the problems, to repair the damage. So that's where you get the term reparation. And so they were just supposed to pay for what they had torn up or messed up. And, you know, then you start to say, well, what does that mean? I mean, is it, there's the 4 miles of the Western Front, and all that's torn up. I mean, it's totally, you know, hammered into, you know, plowed fields, and every drainage ditch is gone, and all the water sources are flowing everywhere, and it's all totally mud and weeds and mosquitoes now, and corpses and of all kinds. And so that's all ruined. It's also just full of explosives and metal and poison gases and poisons from all the bodies decomposing. So that's ruined. So that 400 miles by maybe 20 miles, you know, that's all ruined. So they pay for that. But what else do they pay for? Well, what about the soldiers who were killed because of that? What about all the expenditures for the war effort? What about the pensions to the widows who would have had their husbands if there hadn't been a war then? So you see, that was what all the debate was over. And the interesting thing in this, Brad, is that that in the debate, you couldn't really tell which way the three were going to go. It all depended on their personal proclivities and what their country's interests were. Because in there are many cases, especially on border issues, where Lloyd George was just a voice of reason. Oh, you can't do that to the Germans because they'll try to get back at us later. But on financial issues, Lloyd George was crazy. He ran on the campaign slogan of "Make the Germans Pay." In when they the British had an election in December 1918, it was called the khaki election. That so many soldiers were coming back and wearing the khaki. Cocky, as the British call it. So, you know, Lloyd George was tough. The Clemenceau, the tiger, who was just ready to hammer the Germans in every way he could possibly do it, said, well, you know what? If we make the bill too high, if we don't tell the Germans some that they'll agree to easily, then we will never get a cent. It's like saying, if, you know, if one of you says to me, well, Hunt, you got this service for me, and now here's the bill. It's $3 million. I'd just say, what? Sorry, I can't pay anything. But now if you said it's $300, I might say, well, you know, I'll save a little on this and that, and I'll pay it a couple of months. So anyway, you see what I mean. That's Clemenceau was thinking that and all that. But they all were thinking in terms of reparation. And then they ran the reparations in different ways. And we'll talk about that later. What they did with the money that they did get. Okay. Let's see. Mark Polyak. Hello, Mark. Good to hear from you. Was the reparations sum of $132 billion to be paid by German real money or fiat money or mixed? No, it was all gold marks, Mark. All the money part of it was gold marks. And then they could pay, as I said, they could pay in cattle or in lumber and in any of these enumerated ways. But all the marks had to be gold. So the Germans, in a way, and there is some evidence that they really did encourage the, once the inflation started going hyper, they kind of encouraged it to say, well, we'll show those allies. But on the other hand, you know, it didn't make any difference. They had to pay gold anyway. So their game was to make the economy seem ruined so that the allies would say, oh, well, they can't pay anything anyway. You see, but in the end, they had to pay something, even though they paid less than the $132 billion. But yeah, it was in gold. Okay, let's see. More questions. You are very welcome, Mark. Let's see. Rod Huff says this. Do you think Dulles was being disingenuous when he said he did not intend to pin war guilt on Germany with the wording of Article 231. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't think he knew the Germans were going to make such a big deal about it. But, you know, this became, in German mind, all the other stuff aside, I mean, the Germans lost nearly a fifth of their total territory. And they had to pay this big reparations bill. But the thing that everybody talked about all the time was, what? We didn't cause a war. It wasn't war guilt. And in fact, that early revisionist historical movement was all based on American historians saying, no, the war guilt caused. What about that? They're just not that guilty. So this is the thing, and it's one of these public perception things. It's this perception, guilty? No, we're not guilty, that really rankled people. And I'm not sure that Dulles or any of the, I mean, they all passed on it. You know, once he had the idea and saying, look, let's make them responsible for everything. And then gradually that wording, that guilt stuff worked its way in. I'm just not sure that anybody realized what how the German public could be stirred up with this expression, war guilt clause. But on the other hand, I mean, you have to realize if you're writing the word war guilt clause, you have to realize that means something. However, once again, if you like, go look at that copy of the Versailles Treaty on FirstWorldWar.com sometime. Article 231 is in the financial section. I mean, if you read the treaty consecutively, then there's a big heading, and it has to do with finances and money and stuff. And it's the 231 is the first clause in it. Now, it's also true that the last clauses, 230, 229, 228, those all have to do with Germany handing over guilty persons who may have committed war crimes. So again, I mean, you know, I'm not sure what Dulles was up to. To me, Dulles would be right up there with the most knowledgeable of the people as the agent of numerous really influential bankers and whatnot. And he would be among the most knowledgeable people to set up the century or more problems so that those problems could be solved by the companies and governments backed by those bankers. So if there's somebody who is consciously pushing something, I'd nominate John Foster Dulles and his brother and that crowd around them and around Colonel House as well at a different level. But I don't know the full story about them. And you know, there were disagreements among many of these kind of, you know, Northeastern banker insider types as well at the conference. And I'll talk about some of those next week, especially the King Crane Commission at Fulbright. This man who was a sort of troubleshooter for Woodrow Wilson and Crane. But on the other hand, he disagreed completely with other people in the regime. So I don't know. But I would say, I'd say it's a wonderfully interesting question. I'm betting Dulles knew something, but I bet everybody else was a little surprised when the war guilt became the main cause that issued formulas. The 132 billion marks was at the time. It was in money at that time. So it's pretty darn huge. You know, it was huge enough. But Germany was a rich country. I mean, it was before the war. And even after the war, it was a rich country. So, you know, it was a lot, but it was not the overwhelming amount that the Germans sometimes made it out to be. Rod Huff says the wiki article seems to focus only on the article being used to justify reparations, but assumption of war guilt would seem to justify all the rest as well. For example, land confiscation, Polish corridor, etc. Yeah, and again, it's a really good question, and it was never. I mean, popularly, people didn't have a copy of the treaty. You know, in fact, I got to tell you. It's sometimes amazing to me how easy it is that we have, you know, I'll utter an expression like Treaty of Versailles, and Cam will have it up on this little chat list within 15 seconds. But you know, when I was in graduate school, and this was the area of my dissertation research and everything, and you know, it took me a while to figure out where I could find a copy of the Treaty of Versailles. I mean, it was in the American Papers on Foreign Relations, and I knew that, but I thought, well, there's got to be an easier version of this somewhere. And it took me a long time to locate that. So things have changed. And for Germans, half-starving, standing in lines all day long in 1920, 21, 23, you know, they just... Nobody's going to read the treaty. Nobody knew where that thing lay in terms of treaty. They just knew that everybody who had teamed up on the Germans in the war, this was the perception. You know, normal German people said, well, they all teamed up against us. They, France and Russia surrounded us, and Serbia, they forced us to get in a war, and now they say it's our fault. And we didn't do anything. That's what people on the street would say. And we all know it's more complicated than that, but that's what everybody's saying. CAM's already calculated the trillions, so it's a lot of money. Okay. Let's see. So where is the next question? Are you running out of questions? We're getting to now 6:17. Oh, I think there's some more just appeared down at the bottom. Is there any evidence that Article 231 was purposefully mistranslated? No, I think you know, they mainly dealt in French at the conference, but they had the French and English, and everybody was looking at it, and they all knew, basically all the English speakers knew French, and I think the translation is pretty secure on that, for sure. As far as the German version, their diplomats knew French as nearly as well as any German too. So I think it was all in that way, all in the up and up. I don't think there was, now whether they spun it for the newspapers, and it does say war guilt, you know, Kriegsschuld. So I don't think there was any hanky panky of that sort, because it was just impossible, because it was in black and white. Let's see. And Rod Huff says he thinks the translation was pretty accurate. Yeah, I think so. They're all pretty clear words in French. To tell you the truth, French is, in that context, in the context of the treaty, it's more precise than English. And so so they could get all that down. Okay, do we have more to go through? We will be talking much more next week about the effects of the Versailles Treaty. We'll move our way up into the 20s. We'll talk about a whole lot of specific issues. Yes, Nathan, Ayn Rand, absolutely another one of these, great fighters for individuals. Yeah, I meant to put her on the list. In fact, I originally had a little list I was going to put up here, but I kind of got behind and didn't put it up. And I had her on it, and Rose Wilder Lane, and Ed Henry Hazlett, and many other people. But I mean, you think about a generation that contributed something. I would go Ortega. You got Seth, and I'd go. Pretty broad there, and say, you know, there's a whole group of people who went against the tide in a lot of different ways. So yeah, for Ayn Rand, no doubt about it, and the whole case of her escaping from the Soviet Union, all that. Yep. I don't want to shortchange you. Any more questions? Oh, here's one. Rob Gilmore says, and I noticed today in going through, we have two Gilmores in the class, Maggie and Rob, so, but they're different spellings, so I don't guess you're related. But, was there anything like ethnic cleansing, ethnic armistice? When did that term come into vogue? Excellent question, Rob. Yes, there was ethnic cleansing after the armistice. in a lot of different ways. There's some limited ethnic cleansing on the German-Polish border, where in connection with that Upper Silesia thing, there were some Germans who were driven out. There was a good bit of ethnic cleansing in on the Hungarian Slovakian border, and then again on the Hungarian Croatian border. There was ethnic cleaning up of areas on the Bulgarian Romanian border. And I got to tell you, Poland was a very, very aggressive new state, always looking to expand, in spite of the fact that less than half of the individuals in the new state of Poland were actually ethnically Polish. So they did a good bit of preliminary cleansing when they took some places on the edge of the country. It was a highly nationalist party that ended up wielding the most power with the new Polish government. So it was a super patriotic, very aggressive nationalist government. And eventually all of these states will have super aggressive nationalist governments who were very much prone to ethnic cleansing. As far as when the term was invented, the earliest I've seen it in this context was actually in the Polish case, on the German border in December 1918, in the city of what is now the city of Poznań, Poland, Poznań, was then inside the German Empire, and the Germans called it Posen. And right after the, a month after the armistice, a group of German, of the Polish paramilitary types, several thousand, descended on the city, took over the city government, and proclaimed that Posen would belong to the new Poland. When they took over the city, and that was permanent, that's when Posen became officially Poznania and changed back to the Polish name. And those Polish insurgents set up what they call the Committee for the Cleansing of Germans and Jews. So, so in that sense of the modern use of it, that's the earliest I can cite. But I can tell you this: there are some earlier references to it. In the early 19th, apparently it really was a Serbian invention from the early 19th century, when a number of poet intellectuals in Serbia, in talking about establishing their national state, talked about how they need to cleanse it of these other influences. So yeah, in the there's a big gap there as far as I can tell. But in the modern period, the earliest reference I have seen and know about, and that many of my colleagues, those of us who studied ethnic cleansing, the earliest I've seen is that case from December 1918. From and I'm going to probably mispronounce your name, Vangel Vesovsky. Okay, is there any way to improve the quality of the PDF files that show the slides? I think that when they're created in PDFs, your software is choosing the lowest quality level. Okay. We'll see if we can work on that. I've wondered about that. You know, I've tried to keep them a little bit. I didn't know that the program or software or whatever filled with them, but I try to keep them small so it'll be usable. But maybe I need to use bigger images to begin with. They're clear on my copies, but we'll see what we can do. Okay, what's next? Who's got one? This is fun. And so, Cam, are you saying I should send you the slides, or Okay. All right. You mean next week, or just send you this group, this batch? Yes, to which? Next week. Okay. I'll do that. I'll get them done early. Okay. So, and if we need to redo a little bit, we'll redo them. I don't want them to be bad. Okay. Do we have any more questions? Malcolm. Okay, good. I'll ask my long questions on the forum. Excellent. And I will get to them. Yeah, that'd be fun. Everybody, the forum is in action and we're using it. And if you want to go through it and see, there's a little bit of discussion. There could be a lot more and all of that. So please do pay attention to that. From Maggie Gilmore. Now, more Gilmores. Do you have any thoughts on this year being the 100th anniversary of World War One starting? I would love to get some conversations going on that in my area. Yeah, I mean, it's just it's a great commemorative device, and everybody's interested in it, and I think it's a really good chance to think about what the state has meant in terms of devaluing people's lives. So I'm all in favor of commemoration, as long as it doesn't turn into another good war, you know, a la the broadcasters. Who is it? Charles Perrault? Who wrote The Good War? I forget. Anyway, there's a lot of interest in it right now. A lot of books coming out, and it's exciting that people are more interested in it. Evangel Vasovsky says, I am more interested in the parallel between 1914 and 2014. From what I can see, we seem to be in a similar place today. How so, Benjamin? And this could be a good topic for the forum as well, but I'll just ask you that question now. It may be too long to type it all down. I bet it is. But if so, you can easily put it on the forum. Well, that's certainly true. And it's the same. I mean, in a way, the processes that are in train now are those processes kind of invented. I mean, in a way, you have to step back and admire the genius of people who could set up a kind of system that would mean more advantage and more control as time went on. I mean, admire in a horrible way. You have to admire the far-seeingness of all that. Maggie says, very good point. I'd like to maybe organize some film screenings or book discussions leading up to the anniversary. July 28th is also my birthday, coincidentally. Excellent. And so you're interested in those movies. We haven't discussed the movie very fully, but we've started, haven't we, on the forum. That's a good discussion for everybody to get into, because everybody knows, everybody's seen something different. Vangel says, I'm thinking of the talking haircuts, nice phrase, on Fox, CNBC, etc., who are pushing the interests of poor parties and war profiteers. Yeah. Well, that's certainly a genuine parallel, this enthusiasm for war, for sure. And Leslie suggests the Mises Institute has some special lectures on World War One. That's a great idea. Yeah, that's a good phrase, talking haircuts. I like that. Okay. Well, listen, we can easily just take all this to the forum. Maggie says, so far I've only watched Paths of Glory, really a revelation. I've fallen prey to somewhat writing off the war films as far as being glorifying. That film is about the least glorifying film for war that it was ever made. So there's some pretty good stuff out there. Gallipoli, see Gallipoli if you haven't, Maggie, and see what you think about that. Are we ready to shut her down? This has now been 2 hours, and I hate to impose upon your Goodwill. So I wanted to say that's that we've had a good class. I mean, we had a good shot at the material and call it a night. I hate to let anything go unanswered, but we've got a lot of class left to build. Thank you all. Thank you all. And Cam is going to go back to the Roman Parthian Wars from whence he came. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. That was fun for me. And I look forward to next week when we take the whole thing back up again, move our way into the 20s and talk about the Nazis and talk about a lot of different interesting things. So I will see you then. Cam officially says it is coffee time. So we will all adjourn to coffee. Okay. Good night.